By way of background, I'm a medical doctor. I trained in New Zealand. I then specialized in general surgery. I worked in Africa, and I've been in the UK since the early 90s or late 80s. And I worked for 27 years with the Christian Medical Fellowship of the UK, which brings together about 5,000 doctors and medical students. And then for the last 3 years, I've been with the international organization, the ICMDA, which brings together over 80 national associations of Christian doctors and dentists. So that's where I'm coming from. But I wanted to start off looking at this whole subject of bioethics, and we're going to focus much more on life ethics than anything else, just probably for reasons of time. You're very welcome to come in. With the starting point, this is Michelangelo's portrait of the creation from the Sistine Chapel, and it depicts the idea that human beings are made in the image of God. And in fact, it's Genesis 1, 26 and 27, which talks about that fact, that has provided in Western culture and throughout the Judeo-Christian tradition the whole basis for human rights. And it's, in other words, that our dignity as humans is something that is bestowed upon us by the fact that we're made in God's image. It's an act of grace. It's not an act of works by which we earn dignity on the basis of our achievements or faculties or upbringing or race or ethnicity or any other biological or cultural factor. Dignity is bestowed by grace, that every human being is made in the image of God. And every human being belongs to God. The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, Psalm 24, verse 1. And this fellow on the right here is Thomas Sydenham. Thomas Sydenham was a Puritan doctor from the 17th century who medics know him as the name behind Sydenham's career, which is some abnormal movements you get in rheumatic fever. But he was a polymath at a time when it was possible to be one. He was an expert in so many different areas and so many contributions to medicine. But he was a Bible-believing Christian who stayed in London during the Great Plague, looking after his patients, risking his own life. And he taught generations of medical students. And he used to tell them right at the beginning, he'd give them his philosophy of life, and he'd tell them that human beings were precious for two reasons. Firstly, because every single human being was made in the image of God. And secondly, because God himself gave nobility to humanity by becoming a man in the person of Christ. So he saw the roots of man's dignity both in the incarnation and also in the creation as well. And it's interesting to see how people from non-Christian backgrounds today, people who are sympathetic but not Christians, folk like Tom Holland, Neil Ferguson, even Ben Shapiro, and so on, who are writing, they're all coming back to this whole idea that the whole notion of human rights, which underlines the whole of Western culture, had its origins not in the Enlightenment or in Greek or Roman philosophy or anything, but actually in this creation ordinance of human beings being made in the image of God. And so there's the full wording: in the image of God, he created them, male and female, he created them. And it's interesting that this idea is linked in Genesis 1, in Genesis 9, verse 6, in the flood narrative. So this is after Noah and his family have come out of the ark. It's linked with the idea of the sanctity of human life. So whoever sheds human blood, by humans shall their blood be shed, for in the image of God has God made man. See? The death penalty for murder, right in the ninth chapter of Genesis, is linked to this idea. And so this is where the whole doctrine of the sanctity of human life comes from in the Judeo-Christian ethic, that we're made in the image of God, and that therefore that's become the basis of the sixth commandment: you shall not murder, you shall not kill, which actually is prescribing the intentional killing of an innocent human being. That's what it means, the intentional killing of an innocent human being, and provided the framework for our European laws in this area. So Exodus 20 and Deuteronomy 5. And in the Old Testament, you'll find, even under the New Covenant, that the Bible only sanctioned the killing of guilty human beings in specific circumstances, specifically in capital punishment, in holy war, and in self-defense. If in defending your home from someone who'd invaded, it resulted in their death. And there are passages in the Pentateuch, in the first five chapters of the Bible, which unpack this principle and make it abundantly clear and unambiguous that the meaning of the word ratshak in the Old Testament, or phoneuo in the New, meaning to kill, what it really means is the intentional killing of an innocent human being. So it's intentional to separate it from manslaughter, which is unintentional. It's killing to separate it from letting die, the act of taking it of life. And it's of a human being. In other words, it does not apply in the same way to other species. And if we scroll on through the Old Testament, we find all the way through this concept of the shedding of innocent human blood as one of the things which God detests. And not many Christians are aware of this, but when we look at the reason for the exile, you know, when the nation of Judah in 587 BC was attacked by the Babylonians and people were taken off into exile for 70 years at the time of Esther and Daniel and his friends and Nehemiah and so on, that time of history, the book of Kings tells us that these things happened to Judah according to the Lord's command in order to remove them from his presence because of the sins of Manasseh and all he had done, including the shedding of innocent human blood. For he had filled Jerusalem with innocent blood, and the Lord was not willing to forgive. Manasseh, of course, was one of the bad kings of Judah. And, of course, because of God's mercy, it was several kings later that the exile actually happened. So if we're thinking about a Christ-like approach to ethics, if we're to make decisions and think about things in the way that Jesus did, then I think these four principles are important. Firstly, we've got to have a Christ-like mind or a Christian worldview. So what is a Christian mind? Well, it's to recognize first that we are created in God's image for a relationship with him. To recognize second that we are, although we're made in the image of God, we're fallen and we're flawed and we're sinful, and that's had consequences for us. We're flawed masterpieces for our relationships, for our relationship with the planet and with each other, and so on. Thirdly, that God is a God of redemption who has demonstrated his redemptive qualities in his dealings with the Jewish people, and then, of course, more perfectly in the person of Christ, who was God in the flesh, entering our world to die on a cross and rise from the dead in order that we might be reconciled with God. But we also see God's redemptive purposes in the way he provides for human beings' needs, that he makes us, gives us a rational universe. He makes us stewards of the planet. He calls us to care for creation in the way that he himself did. He gives us such things as science and technology that we might use them for the good of human beings. And then the fourth thing, that we look forward to this future hope of the new heaven and the new earth, where all things will be made new and there won't be any dying or suffering or pain, as we read in Revelation. So a Christian worldview, one looks at the world in this way in terms of creation, humanity, redemption, and future hope. I'd suggest that's the first element. The second element of being Christ-like in ethics is Christ-like obedience, that we're called to obedience. It's not just an Old Testament command. Jesus says, if you love me, you will obey my commandments. He sums those commandments up in the great two commandments of the Old Testament, loving God and one's neighbor, which are themselves a summary of the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments, and the much wider law. And so there are principles that we're meant to follow, to respect human dignity, to treat it with respect, with wonder, with empathy and also protection, including legal protection, because human beings are precious. Other principles, the complementarity of the sexes. The Bible is unashamedly binary in that regard. Stewardship and science, that we are given a responsibility to care for the planet and for its inhabitants as God's vice regences. The sanctity of life, which we've already touched on. The marital purity, that the context for sexual relations is within a lifelong covenant relationship between one man and one woman, Genesis 2:24, which of course Jesus picks up and Paul does as well. That children are a gift given by God, they're not our possessions, and we're to act as their protectors. The principle of confidentiality, that we should not use information about people against them for their harm, but only for their good. And the principle of justice and equality, that God calls us to act justly, to love kindness, and to walk humbly with him. And that the relationship between ends and means is that the means are not a justification, or that the end is not a justification for the means. In other words, we're called to do God's work God's way. We can't break God's law and his commands in order to say that we're seeking a higher good. So Christ-like mind, Christ-like obedience, and when it comes back again to the whole sanctity of life ethic, this is whole question of, okay, but when does human life begin? From when does human life have dignity? And even though the Bible doesn't spell it out explicitly, it's very clear of the importance of the event of conception, over 60 biblical references to that event, the many references in Scripture to life before birth, in the lives of the prophets, in the lives of examples of the sons of Isaac wrestling in the womb together, and of course Psalm 139, which talks about us being framed in our mother's womb. And fascinating that Jesus is present in the womb in the first month of his life. How are we told that? Because he's prophesied over, blessed is the fruit of your womb, and a very early pregnancy, we can work out from the context. And that Jesus became, we're told that Jesus became flesh in John 1:14. It's interesting there that the tense in Greek that is used is not a tense which provides which prescribes a process going on over time, but the aorist form of the past, which describes an event which happens in a moment of time, which, given that the angel appeared at his conception, would seem logically to point to that. So I mean, what I'm saying in a sense is that the witness of Scripture is not just that all human life is sacred, but that it's sacred from the very first point of its existence. So, and we know from science and from biology that the individual human being begins when sperm meets egg at the time of conception. And that there's no sort of accumulation of more and more value that goes on. And of course, that fits with the idea of grace, that dignity and worth is something that's bestowed on us from outside, and it's not a consequence of what faculties we might have. So you can't argue that because a human being is less developed or more disabled, that it is of less value in God's sight. And if Jesus was made in this way, then, and made like his brothers in every way, then the same must apply to us. And why is this important? It's important because in the area of bioethics, there is a lot of stuff involving the embryo. And of course, behind that is the question, well, what is the embryo? Is it just a bunch of cells or one cell, even if at the early stage, or is it something much more than that? And you'll see, even in Christian circles, a lot of arguments that are brought up to demean or diminish the status of the embryo. We haven't got time to unpack them all here, but just, you know, you'll often hear people say, they're only potential human beings. No, they're human beings with potential. There's a difference. Well, they're not capable of independent existence. Well, yes, but that's true of a newborn baby, true of most husbands too, possibly. They're not rational or communicative. Well, but neither is a newborn baby or someone who's elderly with dementia and so on. They have a high mortality. Well, we wouldn't argue that people in parts of the world where there is a high mortality among children are of less value. The conception is a process that's not complete until the time of birth, I hear people say. Life is a process that is not complete until the time of death, but we wouldn't argue that right up until the time of death it's admissible to end people's lives. So I'm just giving you a flavour of the arguments against those who would argue that the embryo is not of real value. So Christ-like mind, Christ-like obedience. The third thing is Christ-like character, because in acting ethically, it's one thing to know what the right thing to do is in a certain situation. It's quite another to have the courage and the patience and the character to be able to do the right thing, especially if there's a real cost involved. And so we're called not just to obey God's will, but actually to be more than that, to be imitators of God, to be filled with His Spirit, to be demonstrating the character of God and the fruit of the Spirit, love, joy, peace, patience, and so on. And then finally, the fourth element, Christ-like cross-bearing, that we are called as Christian disciples to follow, to carry the cross. And what does this mean? And I mentioned here John 8, 1 to 11 in the third way. Whatever does that mean? Well, you remember John 8 is the woman caught in adultery. And Jesus is confronted with a dilemma because the teachers of the law say, this woman's caught in the act of adultery. The law says that we should stone her to death. What do you say? And of course, you could see their hypocrisy immediately, because if she was caught in the act of adultery, then there must have been a man there too, and yet only the woman was brought before Christ. And so Christ could have cast the first stone, or he could have said it just doesn't matter. But actually what happened is that he showed both his grace and his mercy in forgiving her and then going to the cross to die for her and the whole world. And so he took the third way, not the way of condemnation, not the way of complicity, but actually the costly third way of incarnation and salvation. And so what does that mean for us as Christians who carry the cross in this whole area? Well, I think on the one hand, it means for us to look for compassionate solutions where there don't seem to be them. And if you think of ethical dilemmas, someone who's dying in extreme pain, you know, either we let them die in extreme pain or we give them a lethal injection. It seems like there's just two polarized alternatives. Well, no, actually, there's a third way. The third way involves caring for them with good palliative care. But you have to be someone who's got that skill, and that's a costly path to walk to get it. Does that make sense? In the same way, you think about abortion. Either we leave this poor single woman with a child that she's not got the capability or resources to bring up, or we give an abortion. It just seems like there's two. No, there's a third way there, which involves the investment of time, money, care, support, antenatal care, and so on, and which has been the motivation of the pro-life movement, who've been involved in providing compassionate alternatives to abortion. Now, don't have an abortion, we'll support you, we'll help you. And so what does that mean, I think, for us in ethics is firstly that we're prepared to invest the time, effort, money, resources to provide compassionate third ways, to see what seem like alternatives that are equally hostile or unsatisfactory. But I think also it means being willing to stand up and be a voice for the voiceless and those who can be exploited and abused, to be a voice for them, even if it costs us something, even if it costs us a lot in terms of reputation, employment, social standing, and so on. So I've taken a bit of time to go through that, but I think if we're talking about being Christ-like in our ethics, so these elements of the Christ-like mind, Christ-like obedience, Christ-like character, and Christ-like cross-bearing together. So having looked at the basis in Scripture, let's just think about our existing culture at the moment, our post-Christian, arguably end-stage European culture on its downward trajectory. And some great books for understanding this and understanding the history behind it all. Nancy Piercy, Love Thy Body, American evangelical academic, came out a few years ago. This is a fantastic book, really very good. And there's, if you just read the introductory chapter, which covers everything in it, you'll get a huge amount out of it. But then there's a chapter on abortion, there's a chapter on euthanasia, there's a chapter on homosexuality, on the hookup culture, on transgender. And she traces all of this back to a misunderstanding of the theology of the body. It's a brilliant piece. Rise of the and Triumph of the Modern Self by Carl Truman, just come out a couple of years ago, which looks at the historical background to woke culture and the sexual revolution. Very, very good. And then a Catholic version of Carl Truman's book is The Global Sexual Revolution, which covers similar ground. And Gabriel Kubi, who's a German Catholic perspective, but comes from a very strong biblical tradition as well. So those are, if you want to go more deeply into it, those are three. But in a sense, what we've seen in Western culture is a move over the last 300 years from a predominantly theistic, Christian theistic worldview to an atheistic worldview. So this idea that most people in Europe held that God existed, that he was an all-powerful creator and sustainer of the universe, that moral good was what was revealed by him in line with his character, that death was not the end but led to judgment, that human beings were made to worship God and to glorify him, and that truth is something that's revealed by God and that is accessible to us through the writings of Scripture and also the person of Christ himself. And then what happened in Western culture? Well, three huge things happened from the end of the 18th, perhaps to the beginning of the 20th century. They had their biggest effect and provided the framework in terms of making atheism credible as a worldview, but also changing the way most people thought, so that we're now living in a culture in Europe where probably about 3 or 4% of people even attend church, and many of those might not even have a really biblical worldview. So, first of all, the Enlightenment, which made human reason the highest authority rather than scriptural revelation. Secondly, Darwin's theory of evolution. And I know that Christians think differently about this, whether you think you're a theistic evolutionist or a young earth creationist or something in between. The point is that Darwin's theory of evolution made it possible to be an intellectually credible atheist in a way that it wasn't possible before. And then thirdly, that higher biblical criticism, especially in the first half of the 20th century, undermined belief in biblical authority. And so these three factors acted as a perfect storm to gradually chip away the dominant Christian theistic worldview, so that we're coming increasingly into an era where atheism is the dominant worldview in most Western countries, that God doesn't exist. If moral good is what we decide, that death is the end, we're just higher animals, clever monkeys, and that truth is something that because there's no God, there's no revelation, so the only way to discover truth is through the scientific method by observation or to derive it from another alternative ideology. And so reaching its zenith in the new atheists like Richard Dawkins, we've moved from a position where most people were Christian theists, even if not knowing Jesus personally, that they subscribed to that worldview, to a position where there were a growing number of atheists, but it was an era of tolerance and respect, to a new situation where Christians are increasingly seen as immoral, homophobic, pestilential, bigots, and so on. And so this view that the theory of evolution explains biological complexity, the Bible is unreliable, and that the Christian God is actually immoral, and that what we regard as good and bad is actually not good and bad, it's the opposite of it. This whole idea of human beings just being the product of matter, chance, and time in a godless universe also found its way into the way that ethics was approached. So we have, I've called this the politicization of the of Darwinism. What that basically means is that the idea of the survival of the fittest, and therefore the destruction of the weakest, by becoming politicized, what I mean is that that increasingly becomes a public duty to ensure that the strong survive and the weak do not survive. And so in its extreme form, humans are just one of many species. You judge the value of human life on its quality, not the fact that it's made in God's image. Only some human lives are persons worthy of respect, and the weak can or actually should be sacrificed for the strong. Of course, this found its most profound expression in the Nazi Holocaust, with a division of humans into different. And completely in contrast to the Christian or Hippocratic worldview, which we'll come back to, that human beings are made in God's image, that all life is of infinite value, every human is worthy of respect, and the strong should make sacrifices for the weak, as Christ did for us. And so we've seen over the last 30 or 40 years or so in particular, the rise of secular bioethics, bioethics based not on the Judeo-Christian ethic or the Hippocratic tradition, but on a secular worldview. And this little book here, Binding and Hock, Permitting the Destruction of Life Unworthy of Life, Its Measure and Form. This was a book written by two Germans, a philosopher and a jurist, back in the 1920s of this last century. And it was used as it laid the philosophical framework for what followed in the Holocaust. And in effect, you know, they say what's whispered in the ivory towers of universities in one generation gets shouted in the streets in the next generation, as it goes through society. And so what these people were saying, permitting the destruction of life unworthy of life, that they were simply saying it's permissible to allow destroying some human life if that human life is unworthy of life. What they called human ballast is the translation of it. And so, you know, you see that worked out in a philosophy that started with small groups of people in pediatric hospitals and in psychiatric hospitals, and eventually spread to cover all non-Germans, where people were divided into two different groups. And we look back on the Holocaust and we say, well, you know, that was another unenlightened generation. We're not like that. But we see similar ideas expressed in bioethics today. So Watson and Crick, the people we know who discovered the molecular structure of DNA in the middle of the last century, and both of them are advocates of infanticide. So both of them have argued that it is admissible to carry out euthanasia on a newborn baby if it carries certain disabilities. I'd say, where did that idea come from? Peter Singer, Australian bioethicist, now in the US, but he and others coined this term speciesism, which means that if you think human beings are a special creation made in the image of God, then that's speciesist. You know, you've got to regard all species like that or none of them at all. And of course, his agenda was not to treat animals like humans so much as to treat some humans like animals. And if you want to trace this back, you could probably find it on Google, but if you put Peter Singer and sanctity of life into Google, you will bring out an article published in the journal Pediatrics in 1983. It's only two or three pages long, and you'll find him very clearly characterize these two different worldviews, the view of the sanctity of all human life compared with the quality of human life, and the seeds of all his more recent ideas about promoting abortion, euthanasia, are all there in that article. In other words, we're just working out this process. And so now in Europe, we're living increasingly in an environment where all the mountains of culture, those institutions which determine the trajectory of the culture in which we live, have been captured and are largely populated now by people with an atheistic worldview, and in particular, who look at and judge human lives on the basis of their quality, not their sanctity. So whether it's the colleges and universities, the worlds of art and entertainment, government, the courts, family, within the business environment and media, that is the view that we get predominantly. And so this is all by preface of saying that that Europe is an end stage culture. That if we look at the descriptions of end stage cultures in scripture and think about Romans 1 initially, the description of the disintegration of Roman culture that's there. And we read there that there were three exchanges that took place. The first was that people exchanged God for idols. The second, truth for lies. And the third, natural for unnatural. And so the immorality in practice in the society followed on from the idolatry at the first level. And if we look back at pagan cultures, especially in the Old Testament, you think of the Amorites, a classic example. The Amorites, of course, were those people under the leadership of people like Og, king of Bashan, and Sihon of Heshbon, who lived east of the Jordan. And you remember when Israel came out of Egypt, and they spent 40 years in the wilderness, but then they went up the east of the Jordan, and they were not allowed to touch the Edomites and the Moabites and the Ammonites, because they're all descendants of Esau, the sons of Lot, and so on. But the Amorites were another thing altogether. And the Israelites became God's instrument of judgment upon these folk. And you read right back in Genesis 15 that is a rather fascinating prophecy where it's the passage where the covenant is made with Abraham. And you remember Abraham is to cut animals in half, and then this flaming torch comes out of heaven and goes right down the middle of them. And this covenant is made between God and Abraham. But in that passage, God says, and your people will be kept as slaves in Egypt for 400 years. Do you remember how the verse ends? Because why? Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Your people will be kept as slaves for 400 years because the sin of the Amorites is not yet complete. Yeah, fascinating. And so they were kept for 400 years in Egypt. Why? Predominantly because of God's mercy on this pagan culture, that it was going to be another 4 years before their final judgment would take place. But the marks of pagan culture, I think, there are three. Idolatry, first of all. Secondly, sexual immorality. And thirdly, linked to that, is the shedding of innocent blood, and in particular, child sacrifice. Read that into modern culture. And I think we're living in a society now, in a post-Christian end-stage culture in Europe, where we're seeing the three exchanges of Romans 1, and we're seeing the three markers of Amorite culture very much there as well. I've referenced Camille Paglia's video on transgender and cultural collapse. If you haven't seen that, Google it, find the YouTube video. You'll find a non-Christian feminist philosopher there talking about the rise of transgenderism and how it was the classic marker in history of an end-stage culture, and that we were therefore, she's saying this as a non-Christian, that we're living in the West in an end-stage culture because of that. So that we're living at a time when the foundations are being destroyed. Psalm 11, when the foundations are being destroyed, what can the righteous do? And what are the foundations that have been destroyed? Well, let's go back again to the first pages of Genesis and what we know as the creation ordinances or the principles that are laid down in those chapters. And here is just some of the things that are under attack in post-Christian Europe. First of all, theism, the idea that God exists, that he's separate from his creation, that that death is not the end, that we're made for a relationship with them. Secondly, that human beings are made in God's image. Thirdly, the binary nature of sexuality, the Bible being unashamedly binary in saying male and female, he created them. Fourth, the idea of stewardship, that we're made responsible for caring for the planet and everything in it as God himself would do. Marriage as the context for sexuality. And then, as we've already spent a lot of time on, the principle of the sanctity of life. So these were the foundations of Judeo-Christian culture, of Western civilization, and what I'm saying is they've all gone. And so it's like living in a tower or in a skyscraper where all of the foundations have been taken out. And it may look okay still, or think of a great tree where the roots and the lower stem have all rotted away, and it may look okay, but actually it doesn't take much to bring it to a crashing end. And other people have likened Western culture to a rose in a vase where the water has run out, and you still see the bloom and some of its beauty, which is beginning to fade, but actually it's cut off from its roots and any sustenance, and inevitably it's going on this downward trajectory. And as Christian believers, what we're called to, all the way through Scripture, to be a voice for the voiceless, to speak for those who cannot speak for themselves, to rescue those who are being led away to death, and hold back those staggering towards slaughter. God's people are to be a prophetic people. So we've looked at the biblical foundations of the sanctity of life, the way the elements of a Christ-like ethical approach, and then at the trajectory of Western culture as well. And now just want to look at what's happening in Western culture more specifically. So you've all heard of the Hippocratic Oath. All doctors used to have to take it. They don't now in many medical schools. The main reason for that is because actually the Hippocratic Oath says you shouldn't commit abortions. And yet Western culture has embraced abortion effectively as a way of life. So I will give no deadly medicine to anyone if asked, nor suggest such counsel, nor in like manner will I give a woman a pessary to produce abortion. So the Hippocratic Oath from 600 BC from Hippocrates regarded both abortion and euthanasia as inadmissible. But since the Second World War, this idea held up pretty much to the 1940s, but since that time, things have been gradually eroded. So at the end of the Second World War, there was a declaration put out called the Declaration of Geneva, which all the World Medical Association signed up to. And it said, I will maintain the utmost respect for human life from the time of conception. Even under threat, I will not use my medical knowledge contrary to the laws of humanity. And this has now been amended. In 1994, the word conception has been replaced by the word beginning. But beginning is conveniently left undefined, you see. And so, and that's because the medical profession had a dilemma. Our ethical codes say, don't commit abortion, but it's become part of our medical practice. So we've clearly got a choice. We change our practice or we change our codes. Well, let's change our codes. That's what happened. And so we're now in a situation where if you take all human deaths in the world, 42% of them are babies dying in the womb from abortion at the hands of nurses or doctors. 57,000 deaths in the world every year, approximately. 42,000 abortions. Okay? So 42% of all human deaths every year are from babies dying from abortion. Or in other terms, there is no one more innocent, more vulnerable, or being killed in greater numbers than the baby in the womb. Being a baby in the womb is the unsafest place to be. if you are a human being. So that just codifies the numbers, but compares 43 million, 55 million total human deaths in the whole of the 5 years of World War II. So that's a big number. And the countries where abortion is legal or on demand are those in red. And you can see there is still some restriction on abortion law, particularly in the global south, in South America and Sub-Saharan Africa and in the Middle East, North Africa region. In fact, there were so many abortions that it was changing in parts of the world, the whole demographic structure. So Russia, at one point, were carrying out more abortions than there were live births. And as a result, with a growing elderly population, there were fewer and fewer younger people. And so Russia made a very pragmatic decision to restrict abortion just so that the whole demography of society would not change. Similarly, in China and India, 160 million missing women in China and India. Why? Because of preferential female abortion and all that that does to fuel such things as human trafficking as well, or sexual abuse. This is the sex ratio at birth in different countries, and the average is 105 males to 100 females, but you can see the three tall ones there are Vietnam, China, and India because of female feticide. Artificial reproduction, of course, we've developed the technology here hugely. Many millions of babies now produced worldwide, but some of the associated techniques involve embryo experimentation, destruction, or surplus embryos that are never implanted. What's becoming ever more accepted process is what we call prenatal selection, which is diagnosing disabilities before birth and either aborting the children or doing it at a much earlier stage at pregnancy through other technologies that we have. A contraception, how is this relevant? Well, the point is that there are some forms of contraception that act after the time of fertilization with an egg and sperm come together. And then if we go to the other end of life, and this is what I want to say a little bit more about, is the whole euthanasia thing. Where is euthanasia and assisted suicide legal in the world today? Well, there are 10 US states, in Canada, of course, more recently in Europe, it's the three countries of Netherlands, Luxembourg, and Spain, and also Belgium as well. So there's the US, mainly in the northeast and west of the country. Same-sex marriage, pretty much Western world. You can see there, Spain, Austria, Belgium, I'll make a comment about this. These are age pyramids from the country of Japan. And in the far left, that's the age structure from 1950. And you'll see that 35% of people in Japan in 1950 were 14 years or younger. And just 5% were 65 or older. By the time we get to just over 2007, it's 13% younger than 15 and 21% greater than 65. It's a massive shift. And then what's projected for 2050, 40% over 65, just under 9% under 15%. Why? Well, it's a combination of reasons. One of them is abortion. One of them is that people are choosing smaller families. Another of them is that we're getting better at looking after people who are older. But as well as the huge change in proportions, you notice that also the number of people in the 15 to 65 age group, and that would include most of the working population, peaked in the middle, but is getting smaller and smaller. And so you've got fewer and fewer people providing the support for people at both ends of life. But it's the shift to the older population that is incredibly important. Now, if you put into this scenario toxic debt and intergenerational conflict and so on, and the growing atheist ethic, then you can see why some commentators are saying that the generation that killed its children through abortion will in turn be killed by its children through euthanasia. Demography is a really big issue, age structure of populations. Of course, most countries in the global south, Africa and Asia in particular, still have age pyramids like the one on the left there. Why? Because there's far less abortion and because the families are much larger as well. So let's just go through very quickly the most effective arguments against legalizing euthanasia. And Christians who are involved in this whole debate, we need to recognize that we're such a small, tiny minority now in Western culture that we're only going to win in the public square, but short of a miracle, by being able to work with others who do not necessarily agree with us on other issues, but share our concerns about what the issue we're fighting on. In other words, we've got, in lots of areas of debate, there are people who are co-belligerents. In other words, they share our convictions on some things, who we can work alongside. And all of these areas, I've just indicated here on the slide, but Christians are not the only people to oppose euthanasia. Many healthcare professionals, especially doctors, do. And a very strong lobby which is against euthanasia is the disability rights lobby. And so we need to work with these folk. I've listed some other debates, like conversion therapy. It's not just Christian voices who are not supporting it. The whole transgender thing. If you came to an earlier seminar, we were talking about how the rise of the gender critical movement, groups of people, including psychologists, feminists, lesbian and gay groups, parents of children who are gender conflicted, are all now expressing concerns about the whole transgender movement going too far. We can work with folk like this. And even in the battle against loss of freedom of speech, we've got comedians, we have the LGBT lobby who share our views on this. Sexual morality, there are growing concerns about it going so far, what we're seeing with the Me Too movement and so on. So Francis Schaeffer said that a co-belligerent is a person with whom I do not agree on all sorts of vital issues, but who, for whatever reasons of their own, is on the same side in a fight for some specific issue of public justice. In other words, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. That's the idea behind it. And this is a very good example of the principle. In Oxford University town in Britain, there was a student, was a policeman on a horse, and one of the students told him that his horse was gay. And the policeman arrested the student and put him in the cells overnight for hate speech, because he'd said that this horse was, he was just joking, but he'd said this horse was gay. And people felt that this was a ridiculous overreaction. And so they wanted to change the law to make it absolutely clear that there was a difference between insulting speech on one side and on threatening speech on the other, and that it should be fine to be able to insult people. And so that they assembled a coalition of people who were backing free speech. And Ron Atkinson, the comedian, came along because he said, well, if we can't insult people, we comedians don't have a career anymore. So I'll work with the Christian Institute on this matter. But what was really interesting was that this chap on the other side is Peter Tatchell, who's one of the leading gay rights campaigners in the UK. And he said, this is ridiculous. People should be able to say things that others that offend others. And so part of their campaign was to put together a pantomime horse that had within it two members of the staff of the Christian Institute, who are a Christian campaigning body, and then another of their staff playing as the student. You see, he's handcuffed to the policeman there, and Peter Tatchell saying, that's insulting your neck. Do you know your horse is gay? That's insulting your neck. And they came down outside of Parliament and got on all the television screens. So it just illustrates the principle that when Christians are in a minority, we need to be able to join together with others who share our concerns on that particular issue and work with them. And this campaign was successful in stopping the erosion of the law on that issue. I'm going to flick on here because I just want to look briefly at the arguments against legalizing euthanasia to illustrate this principle. So as Christians, of course, we believe that it is wrong to shed innocent blood. It's wrong to end the life of an innocent human being. But of course, most people in society don't buy into our scriptural presuppositions. And so what arguments can we use that are going to convince people who are not necessarily Christian, but are still living in a post-Christian culture where the legacy of Christianity is there? And what I was involved in advocacy end-of-life issues for about 12 years when I was with Christian Medical Fellowship, and these are the arguments that we found worked again and again and again with people from all backgrounds and both right and left of center politically, that are based on principles in scripture but are not explicitly scriptural. And so the first argument was that if you change the law to allow euthanasia, then vulnerable people will feel pressure to end their lives so as not to be a burden upon others. So a change to the law would put pressure because they're afraid they're a financial burden or an emotional burden or a burden of care upon others. And so we shouldn't change the law because then people will feel pressure. We shouldn't be pressurizing vulnerable people. Now, that argument was the best argument and the argument that convinced most. And when it came to the last big euthanasia bill in Britain back in 2015, they threw it out by a huge majority. And this argument appealed to people on both the right and left side of the House, so that not only Conservatives voted a majority against the bill, but also people from the Labour Party as well. Why? Because they still believe in human rights. They still believe in protecting vulnerable people. The second argument is that this is called the slippery slope argument. I prefer to call it the incremental extension argument because for this reason, that slippery slope, you know, if you allow this, this will happen. If you allow this, this will happen inevitably and so on. Slippery slope implies a kind of passive process. You know, you stand on the slippery slope, it's slippery, so you fall down. But what's actually happening in actual fact is that there's an active process of taking more and more ground by those who want to weaken the law. And so a better expression is pushing the envelope or incremental extension to take baby steps to get there. And if you can destroy the principle of preventing euthanasia in its absolute sense, then you can bite off little bits, you see. And if we look at the jurisdictions in which euthanasia has been legalized or assisted suicide, we see that there is incremental extension or mission creep. In other words, you'll hear people saying, look, this is only for terminally ill adults with less than 6 months to live who are mentally competent. It's only for that very small group of people. But once you allow it for that group of people, then because autonomy, it's my right, and compassion, you know, they need it, were the arguments to change the law in the first place. The thing is that those two arguments apply to a much, much broader group of people than terminally ill adults who are mentally competent. And so what you see is this mission creep, whereas if you allow it for the terminally ill, it then spreads to the chronically ill. If you allow it for adults, you then see it with children. If you allow it for mentally competent people, incompetent people, you then see it for mentally incompetent people. So safeguards that you put in place do not work logically because of the compassion and autonomy arguments, but also in practice, because what happens is that once the principle is gone, they'll bring up another case out just outside the boundaries of that and argue for its extension to involve that. And so whether it's Canada, Belgium, the Netherlands, or whatever, you see this incremental extension, an increase of cases every year, but an increase in the category of cases to be included. There's the Belgian stats up to 2020. You can see the steady increase. A third argument which worked was that good palliative care is better. In other words, if you address the symptoms that are prompting the request for euthanasia, then less people are going to want it. If you look after people properly, they don't want it and the need is reduced. And the fact is that most symptoms that prompt the request can be treated and relieved by people who know what they're doing. And in fact, the push for euthanasia is coming not so much for reasons of pain now, but for what we might call existential reasons. These are the figures in Oregon, which has had euthanasia or assisted suicide legalized for the longest. And you can see why are people wanting it. Decreasing enjoyment of life, 90%, loss of autonomy, 88%, loss of dignity, 74%. Well, these are not medical problems. They're existential problems. They're spiritual problems. So why are we offering medical solutions for things which are in reality not medical at all? And then the final reason that we use, this couldn't be used in every country, but in the UK, euthanasia is completely against the law and carries a very high penalty, you see. And yet, when people are involved in assisting a suicide, there is discretion given both to prosecutors and judges to show mercy in hard cases. And so we simply argue that the best law is one that absolutely prohibits any euthanasia, but that you deal compassionately with really hard cases in terms of the kind of penalties that are there. And so the penalties that the law holds in reserve, oh, I might go to prison for whatever, act as a very strong deterrent to exploitation and abuse, whilst at the same time meaning that people are treated with mercy. So the law, if you like, has a stern face, but at the same time it has a kind heart in practice. And so it was for those arguments that, you know, the vulnerable will be exploited, you'll get incremental extension, we should look after people better, and the current law is the best law anyway, therefore we shouldn't change it. And those arguments worked again and again and again and are still working. And when I first joined CMF back in 1992, we were fighting the legalization of euthanasia then, and we certainly didn't think that 20 years later we still wouldn't have lost the battle. But the point is, if you work with others who share your views, and if you find the arguments which connect, even in a profoundly post-Christian culture, you can still win some of these battles.